This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On the UAE's number one talk radio station, Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer, and this is the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast, your chance to catch up on the best bits, or indeed the interviews, the real life stories that you might have missed. Today we've got a real focus on education, children's health and parenting. We were in conversation with Adrian Bathuni. Teaching children and teachers how to be happy and cope with stress, particularly important during this exam season. What are the five ways to wellness? He was sharing those. Noni Edwards joined us in the studio to talk about how internships work for youngsters. You might be looking for summer jobs, but what if you're looking for paid for opportunities? There has been a law change recently, so what do you need to know? If you're struggling to bond with your baby, perhaps you're drifting apart from your teen, Hanan from the Family Hub was on hand talking about attachment and ways you can reconnect. And reading was one of my favourite ways to bond with the kids. So we were joined by Kathy Urban-Oberg, author of a new children's book, talking about a comfort toy and the adventures hers having on those pages. And talking teens, Dr. Chasti O'Connell was discussing the rise of mental health issues, a crisis that we're seeing worldwide. But what about here in Dubai?
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Oh, it takes me back. The revision notes, the revision timetable, and not necessarily in a good way. But one thing I can tell you, it's not just a child that goes through exams. It's the whole household. I furiously remember having to like look busy when I heard my mum's car in the driveway as she was checking up on me. So how's it going in your household? Let us know. It is exam season. And we really want to focus on the well-being of that child. We know that children learn when they're feeling safe and secure and confident. But what if they're not? We're bringing in the expert today. Adrian Bathuni is with us. He's the founder of Teach Happy. He's been teaching happiness and well-being to primary school children and teachers for the last 10 years. He's visiting from the UK. Adrian, I'd love to get your fresh eyes perspective on education in Dubai. You're here in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, kind of visiting schools and speaking at conferences. It's your first time really with that kind of hat on. What have been your first impressions of schools here?
I've been surprised, actually, having lots of conversations with different teachers in different schools here. It's echoing a lot of what I hear back in the UK, which is, you know, there's a lot of pressure on teachers. Teachers are feeling quite stressed. The curriculum is packed, and like, how can we find space to focus on pupil well-being on top of all of our targets and everything else? Mm-hmm. And this is very true back in the UK as well. And it just makes me question, why are we putting teachers and children through so much stress, pressure and anxiety when ultimately we want them to do well in school and enjoy school and enjoy learning?
Now, if you could wave a magic wand then, what would you change about? And you can make enormous changes here. It could be, you know, whole schedules or eradicating certain subjects. If we made you international, you know, Minister of Education, Adrian, what would you like to see in place?
I would like to see just a bit more space and freedom in the timetable and the curriculum. In the UK, and I get the impression here too, we try and cram so much in, and we try and give children so much knowledge and so many skills. And actually, what we're doing is taking away from that inherent love of learning. Like, learning is inherently good for well-being. It's one of the five ways to well-being, backed up by research. But when learning is predominantly extrinsically motivated, as in you need to learn this in order to get this grade, to get into this university, etc., it takes some of that intrinsic enjoyment and fun out of it. And so I would take more out of the curriculum and give more space for children to also follow their own interests, their natural inclinations, to follow the things that they're interested in.
We can't change things right now, but no. We do have control over certain elements of the way they learn and how we support them at home. Tell us a little bit about Teach Happy and where the idea came from.
The idea came from actually a period of poor mental health in my own life. In fact, before I was a teacher, so I used to work in music publishing, and I experienced a period of acute anxiety that led to a bout of depression, something that never ever happened to me before, and I really didn't know what was going on and how to help myself get better or feel better. Luckily, I had supportive friends and family. It helped me through the worst. I saw a counsellor for a bit, and that was really beneficial. But I also started to research stress, anxiety, depression, learn loads about mental health I just didn't know before. I also discovered that there was a science of well-being. So this is the scientific study of what makes life worth living. Mm-hmm. something that came up time and time again was that volunteers are some of the happiest people in society. And once I was feeling much better, I volunteered to be a mentor. This charity called Chance UK in England mentored a 9-year-old boy in Hackney for a year. And that made me realise, actually, I want to work with young people kind of day in, day out. And that's what made me switch careers to teaching. And when I was in the classroom, I wanted to share some of these simple tools and interventions that I'd learned as an adult and found really useful, that on reflection I wish I'd known growing up. And so that's kind of the beginning of Teach Happy, was weaving well-being, weaving these simple tools to increase our levels of happiness into my everyday teaching practice.
Now, you and I are roughly the same age. What were your memories of exam stress back then?
Do you know what? This is a conversation I've had with my best friend recently. You know, we were saying we did GCSEs, we did A-levels. Was it really as bad as like lots of young people are saying it is now? And I think on reflection, what helped us get through our exams was that our school was very sports focused as well as exams. So you couldn't turn around to your rugby or cricket coach and say, "Sir, I can't turn up to training tonight. I've got an essay to write. I've got revision to do." It was very much you come to training, then you do your revision. Mm-hmm. And I think that gave us a sense of perspective, like your exams are important, but so is representing your school at sports. And also we know physical activity is one of the best things you can do for your physical and mental health. So we were regularly being physically active. So yes, I do remember being stressed, but I don't remember being so stressed that I felt like I couldn't cope.
And I feel like that, unfortunately, in some schools or cultures, it is this exam results are the be all end all of everything. And I know that I remember being, you know, if you don't get this, it's going to lead to this. And if you don't go to that university, then, you know, you basically need to be living in a cardboard box, which is not that helpful.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
But before the summer, we have the exams, and getting through them is a testing time for all. We know teachers are working incredibly hard right now, of course, pupils, but also parents supporting them too. So get in touch if there's anything that's on your mind when it comes to this. Adrian Bethune is with us this afternoon. He's the founder of Teach Happy, teaches happiness and well-being to children and teachers for the last 10 years, a former teacher himself. So let's talk about exam stress. I mean, to my mind, I feel like the pressure's on more than ever. I mean, we were lucky enough to kind of come into a pretty healthy job market kind of early 2000s. Oh, in the meantime, we've had a pandemic. Do you feel like the pressure to succeed has increased, or perhaps we're just talking about it a bit more?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really hard to know if children doing exams now are under more pressure than, say, 20 years ago when we did our exams. And that's partly because we haven't measured it. So how can we know? We're talking about it more. Children are more likely now to talk about their mental health and well-being now than, you know, 20 or so years ago. I think something that we do know from research is that, generally speaking, children's mental health and well-being is kind of declining. So there are more children, teenagers in particular, suffering with mental health conditions like anxiety or depression now than there were, you know, 20 years ago. It's partly because we're better at recognising it and diagnosing it. It's partly because children are more open about how they're feeling. But either way, what it means is if you don't have great mental health, you're going to find pressure harder to deal with, which is why it's really important to equip children with the skills to kind of manage stress, to look after themselves, to cope with that increased pressure of exams.
Now, you and I both have younger kids, so I'm sure there's things you're putting in place with them, and certainly as they get older and towards that exam period. But for those parents that do have children undergoing exams, you know, I was GCSEs recently and, you know, all the way through to A-levels, what are some of the things that parents can do on a practical or emotional level to best support them?
It's a tricky one, because on the one hand, you know, you might have a child, a teenager that isn't really putting much effort into, say, studying. And so they need a bit of parental pressure to be like, right, come on, you've got to hit the books right now. At the same time, they don't need too much pressure.
The teenage rebellion is
real. Exactly. And so it's a really fine balancing act. But essentially, I think one of the key things that I think is really important for people to know is that we need stress to perform well. It's not about eliminating all stress. There's even a term called eustress, which is good stress. It's where we reach peak performance, where we learn best, perform best. But it really, that level of stress is typically mild to moderate levels of stress. It's not too hard, it's not too easy. It's that sweet spot in the middle. So it's going to be a constant balancing act. You know, do we put too much pressure on, maybe we need to back off, maybe it's like, right, this evening we're just going to go out for dinner and just not think about studying and take some of that stress off. Maybe at other times it's about, right, for the next hour I want you to go upstairs and kind of get your history books out and focus. So it's a balancing act. It's about you knowing your kids really well and what's going to motivate them the best.
Yeah, carrot or stick.
Yes, exactly.
Latika's been in touch saying, my nine-year-old is going to have his first exams year four end of this month. He's going through some control issues, behavioural changes over the last few months, and I'm not sure how to get him to study independently while at the same time not stressing him out. I don't want him to hate school and studying. And I think that is really what a lot of parents feel like. You know, I want you to do well and I know you're capable, but by applying this pressure, are you then going to, you know, push the books away and reject this idea of learning? Any advice to any to Latika and anyone else going through something similar?
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of the most important things we can do is keep a sense of perspective. Like, how important is it for a nine-year-old to pass these exams? Yes, it's a bit important, but their health, their happiness is far more important than this exam or these group of exams. And you know, that mother said it herself, the most important thing is she doesn't want to put him off learning. Like, learning, enjoying learning is the thing that will get you through the rest of your life. Like, I'm continually studying and learning new things because I love learning. You know, my exams did not put me off learning so much that I just don't want to hit the books anymore. So, yeah, keep that sense of perspective. Like, how much does this really matter? What is most important? And ultimately, you know, kids just need to know that whatever happens, my mum, my dad, my family will still love me. Mm-hmm. Like, their love is not dependent on me doing well in these exams. So it's that kind of unconditional love that really needs to come through at tricky times like exams.
I think a lot of it comes down to that kind of sense of comparison as well, of like, you know, how much are other children working, you know, thinking about what other parents might be doing that's working so-called better. But as you say, you know, at age nine, this is about practicing. It's about, you know, getting used to studying independently. It's about trying out exam skills. And because this isn't, as you say, the kind of be all end all at this age. But what if a child or teen, in this case, a message here saying, is just completely reluctant? No name on this one, saying, my son is an intelligent and very capable lad, good circle of friends, sociable, but he has a huge fear around exams, just can't revise, ends up panicking. He's beginning to show signs of being depressed. Mm-hmm. It's like he has a block. Mm-hmm. Any advice?
Yeah, again, so I still actually do teach still back in the UK. I teach part-time and our year sixes, who are 9, 10 years old, did their SATs for the first time in 2 years. And I was speaking to them and I was saying, how are you feeling about SATs next week? And, you know, some of them were really kind of anxious. And I was like, guys, this is just a chance. These tests are an opportunity for you to show what you know. That's it, okay? And when we think about it, when we get really stressed and really scared, essentially what our brains are doing is reverting back to the hunter-gatherer days where literally there were lions and tigers and predators after us. And we needed that fear in order to fight or flight. But we don't need that part of our brain to operate during an exam, because what happens is the thinking part of our brain actually shuts down, which sounds like it's happening with this boy. And I was just saying to him, look, when you sit down for that test, it's just words on a piece of paper. It's not a tiger sat in front of you. So keep that perspective that it's not a life and death situation. It sounds like that boy needs strategies to manage his stress level. So essentially, he's tipping into that bad stress, that chronic stress, which is your brain literally does shut down. You can't think straight. So, you know, strategies to manage stress. One of the best things we can do is physical activity, because when you're stressed, a hormone called cortisol increases. If it increases too much, shuts off the thinking part of the brain. When we exercise, we use up cortisol. Literally, cortisol levels come right down. Hormones like endorphins, dopamine, these are feel-good hormones. So they make us feel good. They're also called learning hormones. They're neurotransmitters. They help our brains and our neurons and our pathways work more effectively. So a bit of physical activity throughout the day. So something in the morning, after a period of studying, a bit more physical activity, you know, a walk in the evening. You've got to do it throughout the day, not just once a day. Laughing is one of the best things you can do for stress. So I encourage parents to allow periods where their kids can just go on YouTube and just watch some just inane funny clips. Just get those feel-good hormones going again. And the other thing is, the third thing is kind of write like a plan. Have a plan. We were talking about this earlier. Have a plan for revising. Like, okay, Monday, 5 till 6, I'm going to do a bit of a chunk of English. You know, and when you've planned things out, it gives you a sense of control. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I don't have to think about history right now because I'm doing it on Thursday after school. And having that plan gives you a sense of control. And having a sense of control is so important for well-being because it feels like, okay, I am in control. Things aren't overwhelming me. So, yeah.
You talked earlier about the kind of the pillars of well-being. Are you able to talk us through those? Because that might be something valuable to adults as well as kids going through things right now.
Yeah, there are different kind of models of well-being. And one that's really good to remember is the 5 ways to well-being. And it's evidence-based. One of them is exercise, so kind of keeping active. Another one is giving, so volunteering, helping others. Because when you're helping other people, you're not thinking about yourself and your own stresses. Another one is relationships, relating with other people. So hanging out with people that you love and that you like and you have a good
connection.
Laugh with. Exactly. The other one is awareness. It's kind of linked to mindfulness. It's about being aware of how you're feeling, but predominantly trying to tune into what's happening right here, right now. Don't let your mind get carried away with what ifs. And the last one is trying out, which is learning. Mm-hmm. It's learning new things, try new things out, challenge yourself, stretch yourself. So those are kind of 5 key ways to, you know, when we regularly do them, they're often called like the 5 a day. If you can do those things in small ways every day, really good for our well-being.
As long as it doesn't become a to-do list that's going to stress you out more.
Exactly.
Some really interesting messages coming in on 4001 in Massachusetts. I'm a certified mindfulness teacher from the Holland Academy of Mindful Teaching. I'm working with my kids and adolescents with mindful meditation and breathing exercises that really helps their speech or stage fear exam anxiety. Awareness is the key. I believe kids need to help and have the tools to understand that the exam is not the danger. What they fear is humiliation, sadness, being unsuccessful. They're just trying to ignore the pain. And Jan here is saying gamification, the way forward for young learners. There are so many platforms that teachers can use to make learning feel like playing games. This helps children learn. Teachers test without children even realising they're being tested. The interesting thing for the future, my kids love a game. Mm. And we've talked about this on the show in the past, that it's so easy for kind of this, my generation, to be like, that's something for kids. That's not something I'm going to engage with them. But whereas actually it can be something for bonding, for learning. We've run out of time, but thank you so much.
Thanks
it's been for really
me.
Interesting. For people who want to read more about some of your methods and, you know, the ideologies that you've created and indeed picked up over your years, what's the best way of getting in touch with you guys at Teach Happy?
So website is teachhappy.co.uk. It's got one H in it. You can follow me at Adrian Bethune on Twitter or at Teach Happy UK on Instagram.
If you want details of that, by all means, message me on 4001. I'd be happy to send them on.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking teens today, and with the school year coming to a close, some entrepreneurial and enterprising teens are turning their attention to summer jobs, making a few dirhams and getting some worthwhile experience for their CVs as well. So since February this year, teenagers between the ages of 15 and 18 can gain juvenile work permit here in the UAE while continuing with their education. So teens, parents, small business owners alike are looking for more information on rights and responsibilities, the opportunities as well. So if this is something that you can help with, you want to share a job that might be available, maybe you want to share a teen that might be available, get in touch with us now. The ARN News Centre has been looking into this, and we're joined now by Noni Edwards to talk us through what they've uncovered. Noni, what some of the jobs you had as a teenager?
Oh, my first job was in retail. I worked at a bookstore unpacking boxes.
I used to work in a bookshop too.
I loved it.
Me too. The smell of books. I still remember some of the best sellers during that summer that I worked there. I feel like these kind of jobs are so important. Like washing dishes. One of my favourite jobs, working as a receptionist in a gym. I worked at a newspaper counting competition entries. But yeah, a lot of retail. But I feel like it is these kind of customer-facing roles, some of the behind-the-scenes jobs that give you a respect for, you know, money, for
yes.
one thing, but also other people as you move through life, kind of no matter where you are. Now, there was a this is a really interesting topic because I feel like that this is a new thing. This is, you know, the first summer, if you will. Mm. So how did ARN News Centre come across this issue in terms of what's happening in the community?
Well, we stumbled upon a very animated discussion on a Facebook business networking group. It all started when a woman named Yana Samir asked where she should go looking for part-time job opportunities for her three teenagers, 15, 17, 18.
Oh, get them out the house, Yana.
What was the 15-year-old who was the one who was most interested in getting the job? 17, 18-year-olds? Anyway, she told me that she was inundated with responses. And for all those people who did offer her teens jobs, she will get back to them all in good time. But along with all the job offers that she was given, there were also a lot of suggestions for unpaid internships. And that sparked a whole different conversation. Yana says she wasn't that keen on them.
They should learn that they shouldn't be taken advantage of. They're teenagers and like they have a lot of expenses when they want to go out with their friends. They want a lot of things and they should know that they should earn some of that at least.
Interesting perspective. This has been a big criticism of internships, of being like, exactly as she says, people taking advantage, providing you can offer value. If you're going to sit there and be useless, then you maybe don't deserve a dirham.
Well, another woman on the conversation, Bethany Wessel, she made the point that internships do have their place, but they're different to jobs.
I think there's a place for that. And I would say that that place should probably be organized, you know, through the academic programs at schools or in the universities. But as far as, you know, going out and having just a good old-fashioned part-time job, I think kids today want to earn pocket money. And I think a lot of parents today want their kids to earn pocket money. You know, they want them to understand the value of the money.
I would tend to agree with that, with the internships, because they do tend to be more subject or career-focused rather than it being, you know, a bit of cheap labour. So for it to go through, you know, and also from a child safeguarding point of view as well, I think it's really important that that goes through kind of official channels such as a school or a university. So let's talk about the law. Where does the law stand when it comes to payment of part-time jobs under that juvenile work visa?
So we had a chat to Habib Saeed. He's an employment specialist from Squire Patton Boggs. It's complicated, but here he is on it.
It's classed as a juvenile work permit and it should be paid in the same way an employee is paying a normal employee. And when you apply by the Tashiel Centre, they generally will require the employer to input a salary. Unfortunately, there isn't a minimum salary as of yet in the UAE. There is a mention of a national minimum wage in the new labour law, but unfortunately it hasn't quite yet been formalised. And I suspect we'll get a cabinet resolution in due course. But in terms of the pay, very much so, there should be a pay element. It does happen individuals to come on these types of permits and be engaged on unpaid internships, but strictly speaking from an immigration perspective and from a compliance perspective, the employer, the company should offer some form of pay.
So the spirit of the law suggests it should include a salary component. What other things are kind of on the checklist, so to speak, when it comes to making sure someone's a good candidate and a legal candidate as well?
Yeah, so it's a really, really comprehensive system. This element that he outlined here, that the pay element isn't quite formalised. Everything else is very formalised. So the basic conditions are that the young person must be legally sponsored. They have to be sponsored, usually by their parents, that is. There must be written consent from the parent or guardian, and they must have a medical fitness report.
I've never had a medical fitness report.
Really? I think you do for a visa, don't you? You must do.
I've got the old blood tests. Interesting. Okay.
That's the medical fitness report.
Okay,
I think.
Then I'm fine. Yeah. Hopefully. What about working hours or conditions then?
Yep, it's all very, very specified. And some of these are a bit surprising, actually. The work is not to exceed 6 hours per day, and there can't be more than 4 hours straight. So you have to have a 1 hour lunch break, you know, after the first 4 hours to break it up. Now, there's no work after 7 p.m.
Okay.
No work allowed before 7 a.m., so in that 12-hour period. Now, they also cannot work on weekends or public holidays.
Interesting about weekends. Mm. But then I guess if there's going to be very kind of summer focus, then, you know, Monday to Friday, more of your work zone. There is more on this legal requirement over on the ARN News Centre.
There is a lot to drill down on that aspect, yeah.
So, yeah, guys, get your heads around this. But to my understanding, this isn't actually that much of a new thing when it comes to teenagers being employed part-time, am I right?
It's not a new thing. This new permit is a new thing, and it's been promoted very heavily, and people are aware of it for the first time now, but it's actually been in place for about 3 years. It's more streamlined now, and it is more regulated. But one employer that's been hiring teens for the full 3 years is Lush Cosmetics. And I spoke with their head of retail, Caitlin Emke, and she can't speak highly enough of teens.
We love having them on the shop floor. They're energetic. They learn really fast. And they're passionate. They love to have fun. Lush is a really great store to just come in and shop, have a good time, and be yourself as well. So I think it's so important to have a wide variety of different ages to service customers, but teenagers definitely bring a different energy to the shop floor that just keeps your work day going. It's really nice.
See, lots of energy.
That's why I was good at retail when I was a teenager. But I'm curious about it making business sense, I suppose.
Yeah.
Part-time is not really common here, but if anyone's worked in retail in any other country or capacity, it is pretty much the only way to make your retail business model work successfully in order to have the right number of staff on during your busy times and not be overstaffed during your non-busy times.
I never thought about it that way, thinking about doing rotas. Interesting, really interesting. I mean, I know so many people, working parents, people looking to go back to work after, you know, maternity leave or having children or, you know, after an illness, where part-time would just be, you know, a dream.
That's fantastic.
And we know a lot of people that have expressed interest in that, and unfortunately not that many companies who are able to meet that demand. So really interesting to hear that aspect of it as well. For anyone who does want to reach out and share their story, we'd love to hear from you. And Noni, you have, of course, put this together on the ARN News Centre. So if you're looking for more information on the legalities of it all, go over there, check it out. And if you want us to explore it further through the ARN News Centre and, of course, on air as well, get in touch. And Noni, thank you so much for that. Really do appreciate
it. Thank you.
So yeah, get those teens to work. Teach them the value of a dirham and get them out of the house as well.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking family this afternoon, and experts will tell you time and time again that the difference between a confident child and an insecure one, a cooperative child and a defiant one, one that agrees to set the table and one that maybe scoffs and then sets the table, is relationship. You know, what variable could account for whether or not a child is getting their emotional needs met? It's that bond. So we're talking about building and strengthening bonds between parent and child today. Hanan Zeldin is with us, education consultant at the Family Hub. Hanan, great to have you with us today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me back.
I think it's such an important topic because I feel like so many of us have doubts about our bonds from time to time. And this can be from the moment of birth to thinking about, you know, a teen leaving the home and worrying about that future relationship. So I'd love it if it's okay with you for you to start with the importance of early attachment, you know, forming that bond early in life.
Yeah, it's first of all, thank you for having me back. I mean, honestly speaking, it's the relationships that we have with our kids is our biggest investment. And it's not the investment in terms of money, but it's investment in terms of time and that memory that they get to, you know, to remember years and years later. It's, I think, one of the most important things that we have to think of is that eventually, you know, the kids will give us that unconditional love and they'll look for us to support them because they need us for basic survival when they're little. But as they grow older, that relationship needs to really have that extra edge, and that, you know, they need to rely on us for more than just, you know, who's going to feed them and who's going to put them to sleep and who's going to send them to school. But they actually look forward to a relationship with us. And that's what we look forward to.
That's the hope, isn't it? Because, you know, we're talking about teen mental health in an hour's time. And my hope as a parent, and, you know, they're young now, is that there will be that openness, that communication and a willingness to share. Because, I mean, I want them to be able to tell me, I was going to say everything. I don't want to know every single detail. But, you know, I want to know the big stuff, because now to them, everything's big stuff. You know, it's about things that happened at school or did you know or something they found out. And for me, while, yes, I do kind of joke quite a lot on my Instagram about, you know, the questions I get from my kids, having that bond is so, so important. But it's not always easy. And I'm happy to be honest that
you know, when I had my second, I didn't bond with her immediately as a baby. And I feel like that's one of the big myths about motherhood, that that bond is going to be there immediately from the second you lock eyes and that baby's placed in your arms. Is that something you've spoken to parents about in the past?
Yeah, and a lot of parents, when thank you for being honest about that, Helen, because a lot of parents, will, if they don't get that instant bond, they'll feel guilty. And they'll feel that, you know, and a lot of times the moms are overwhelmed with, you know, postpartum depression and a lot of things. So it hinders that, you know, that relationship and that bond. But it's actually much simpler than this. So let's talk about basics. If we have like a toddler or a baby listening to music that they like and just enjoying, you know, these little nursery rhymes and the songs that they like and the tunes that they enjoy is a very, very strong bonding method. And then when they grow into their teens and you start listening to things that, for me, for example, I'm listening to rap these days because that's what my teenager is into, which is not me at all and nothing, you know? But I'm doing it because it's giving me room for conversation with him. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, he makes fun of me sometimes because I don't understand what these people are rapping about. But it gives room for these conversations and for these discussions. And the kids appreciate it when we make that effort to, you know, get closer to them and understand what they're like. And it gives us a little bit of insight about what they're thinking as well, whether they're 2 or whether they're 18.
A message here from Dan saying, gaming and gardening, big hits in our household. That's really nice to hear. For us, and I know I talk about Lego a lot, and I am officially an AFL, an adult fan of Lego. Yes, I enjoy the building and the creativity, but what I think we really get out of that is Lego really is just a tool to bring us together. It is about talking and having a shared project and something that we're working towards together or side by side.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live on the line to talk about emotional attachment and really enjoying each other's company, even when you haven't got much time, is Hanan Azeldin. She's an education consultant at the Family Hub, and loving your messages on what works for you. Aklam saying, cuddling and reading with the smaller ones and gaming with the big ones. We were just talking about the importance of gaming, and this is something we should be leaning into. Hanan, you're listening to rap with your kids. For me, Lego. I love the fact that reading's mentioned because I feel like that's such a lovely time to be close to each other and have that kind of shared experience and a nice wind down too. Now, Amber's been in touch with this message and I'm very curious to get your thoughts on this, Hanan. Amber says, great timing. Hi, both. My husband's workplace, US company, gives its employees 2,000 dirhams baby bonding money when they or their wife gives birth. It's a cash gift. There's no rules. I'm giving birth to our first child in August, so we're going to be the lucky recipients of this generous gift. But what should I spend it on? Any goods or services are possible. What would enable quality baby bonding time? Where is he working, Amber? That's what I want to know. Hanan, what a brilliant initiative. I wish more places thought of things like this. What comes to mind? 2,000 dirhams to baby bonding time. What do you think, whether it's equipment or services? What do you reckon?
I would go for something like baby swimming time. Mm. This is something that I think is amazing these days, that they teach kids, babies how to swim. And then we're all together in the pool and we all get to do it together. I think it's one of the best ideas ever to create that bond time. And, you know, other like baby classes, there are so many around Dubai that, I mean, she can use and she can go to if we're talking about, you know, that sort of quality service.
Love that idea. I would definitely do experience as well, whether it was baby massage. We did, you know, music monkeys, I think it was called. Or maybe keep some aside for a sleep consultant in case you need it. That might yep. help you with your relationship with your baby as well. Speaking of baby massage, what about physical touch? What role do you think that plays when it comes to, obviously, that physical closeness, but that emotional connection too?
Yeah, and most of us have one of our love languages, and one of the 5 love languages is the physical touch.
Mine.
We all crave it. We all need it. 100%. Like, we all need it.
Honestly, social distancing was torture for me, Hanan. I'm used to going up to people in spinnies and hugging them, and I was like, not allowed to do that anymore.
My students are outside, they're laughing because I just said that because they heard it and they know that I had a problem, you know, not giving them a hug when they had a bad time and so on, so they're outside laughing now. But like, jokes apart, seriously, it's I think the more we provide that emotional attachment with the kids when it comes to, you know, a hug or a pat or just something simple like that, really makes a difference, especially when they're teenagers. Mm-hmm. And when they start to reject it, when they don't want it anymore. But then when it counts, Helen, they're going to come back and throw themselves in your arms if they're used to it.
I've got a question here, an anonymous question, in which we always say is absolutely fine. We honestly just want you to get answers, reassurances, maybe an action plan. Anonymous saying, thanks for this. It's my husband who hasn't bonded with our daughter. She's 6 months old. He works away a lot. And when he's at home, he feels his time is precious, doesn't want to, quote, waste it doing things he doesn't like. And being with her sadly falls into this category. He says he wants to spend time with her, but he always feels now is not the right time. I've tried to force the issue, but end up with a resentful husband and a distressed daughter if I throw them together, and I don't know what to do. That sounds really, really tough. What advice would you give to this listener?
It's tough, but it's common, unfortunately. A lot of the times, the fathers will say, you know, I'm not doing the nursing, I'm not doing the changing the diaper and all that. And this is actually when the bonding starts, because mm-hmm. that's when the kids start to understand that they need us and they want us around. So when the fathers miss out on that part, it becomes very stressful for everybody. And the fathers feel left out as well. So he might be giving the resentful attitude because he doesn't know how to fix it. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I would recommend is, first off, take a breather. Go out on a date together, just both of you, without your daughter. And then when he's relaxed and when he's chill, have a conversation about this. Try to get him in on those little tasks. Maybe have like half an hour whenever he's there, just him and her together, playing with something very simple, or just, you know, holding her. That's when the attachment starts to come. If we force it, then he rejects it. So we don't want to do that. We want to get him in, you know, very slowly, very peacefully, and then he's going to want to do it himself.
Thank you for acknowledging that with dads, because I feel like that is such a common thing that not many people talk about, that men can feel, especially if you're breastfeeding, can feel like a bit of a spare part for those first, you know, 6 months. Yeah. And it does take both parties to go, do you know what? This is going to be my role. I'm in charge of X, Y, Z. And I know I was guilty of it, especially with my first, of going, that's not how you do it. You could do it, but, you know, what? This is how we do it. Which, no one's encouraged by that. Of course, my husband was like, fine, you know, crack on with it. You've clearly decided I'm not good enough. The other thing, my husband would be the first person to say this, was that, you know, not all ages are for all people. And I think around that 6 month mark, you do start to get those reactions, you know, the smiles when they come in, when you come into the room, and they're not such, and I loved my babies, they're not just little lumps anymore, they're little people. And my husband has always said, you know, this might not be the age where I'm, you know, at my best as a father. Maybe it's going to be when they get older and I can, you know, do physical stuff like, you know, skateboarding and riding bikes or art projects with them. And I think to have acknowledged the fact that, you know, you don't want to force this issue is really important. And for anyone that is struggling with this on an emotional level, when do you think it's worth going to speak to someone and you know, kind of talking it through?
Whenever you feel like you're losing your kid, or that your child might be going through something and you're not really reaching them and so on, please seek professional help. There are so many amazing professionals in the UAE that you can just reach to, and everybody is always available when it comes to things like that.
Hanan, what else apart from rap is working in your household?
A few things, actually. One of them is my son is a football freak. He's a teenager now. And, you know, we go to training. We got to know the parents of his playmates, you know, and we hang out with them. They hang out together. When we create this community of, you know, kids, and then we know the adults, and the adults know everybody, we start to have these conversations about, oh, you know, who said what, and who did what, and who was great on the field.
And
today,
you know who they're talking about as well. You know, you know who these kids are. You've got context. I think that is really key. Thank you, everyone, for getting in touch. We've got this from Shaksu on the line.
I've got an 11-year-old daughter, and being a dad, it becomes sometimes difficult to connect with her. But one thing that's been constant ever since she was little is our love for music, right from sitting with her, playing on the piano, and now to making some grooves. Sometimes she would come and just ad-lib. songs, which, yeah, they would be made as songs with lyrics and stuff. And we would record them. And obviously, they won't reach Spotify very soon. I'm sure of that. But yeah, they'll be something that we can laugh together many years down as a bond that hopefully we share even then.
I love that, Shaxi. Thank you so much. I feel like this is the next Von Trapps. That's why not be on Spotify? Hanan, thank you so much as ever for your insights. I think it's really fantastic to kind of check in with ourselves from time to time and think, you know what? Why don't we try something different? Why don't we go somewhere, create some memories, or just start to, you know, weave in some of these small little day-to-day habits that can bring us closer together. For everyone who does want to check out your Instagram, and it's a brilliant resource in English and Arabic for parents, what's the best way of getting in touch?
Thank you, Helen. It's at thefamilyhub_Hanan.
Thank you
so
much.
We're always happy to have you on.
And next time I want you to hear some, when you just spit some rhymes, get some raps on Dubai.
The move is on.
And I'll control your levels on the microphone. Hanan, thank you so much.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We've just been discussing the importance of bonding with our children. And for me, reading every night is honestly one of the things I look forward to most. Curling up with them, maybe having a little argument about how many books we're going to read is the classic at the moment. We get that I'm five, so I get five stories. I'm like, I would like to go to bed before 10 p.m. But we're welcoming the author now. Kathy Urban Oberberger is with us. And how many of you had a comfort toy growing up? Go on, send its name in. How many of you kids won't go anywhere without theirs? Well, Kathy is the author of Hop Lola Hop, which is a brand new book coming out in June. It's all about losing something or someone special. Kathy, thank you for being with us today. And I was lucky enough to get a little sneak peek at the book a couple of days ago. And it's already in the car, which is the highest praise for the way to school journey.
Oh, wow. I'm honoured. This is amazing. This is really good to hear. Thank you.
I say this because my children are, like most children, brutally honest. If they don't like something, they will cast a glance at it and lose interest. But the fact that my five-year-old said, can I read it in the car? She's just learning to read. So it's tucked in the seat in front of her and she was reading it this morning. So yeah, you can get a review from a five-year-old that it's lovely. So as I said, it is centred around, I have a comfort toy, a little best friend, which is what a lot of kids have. And you've brought her into the studio. You brought Lola the bunny. Tell us about Lola.
I brought the actual Lola because, yes, we have Lola in the book. And then there's Lola, the real life toy bunny, who belongs to my eldest daughter. And she's the one who actually inspired the book. She is, as you said, she's a comfort toy. So, when my eldest daughter was a baby, you know, we'd have her in the pram. And then later on, you know, she would go into bed, you know, to bed with her. She would snuggle up. And then whenever we would go out for walks or to the supermarket or even on holiday, we'd take her with us. And most of the time it was okay, but then every now and then we lost her.
And it is the end of the world. We've all seen those
that
Facebook posts saying,
yes,
we've lost this toy. Did you see it in Imbatuta? Or do you have one that's identical so we can do a cheeky replacement? It's devastating for children when it goes missing.
It is, because they're so absorbed in their own little world. You know, you as an adult, you think, oh, you know what, it's fine, we'll just get another one. Mm-mm. No, it does not work. Like, it's this or nothing else. And to be honest, I sort of forgot to read that sort of little, you know, the little thing in the parenting manual that said, have a backup toy. I didn't. So I had this one. I was like, oh my gosh, you know what? I have to really think of my feet what to do. And I think the first reaction I had is like, you know what? I think she's fine. I think she's probably just having some ice cream. It's been really hot today. What flavor do you think she might have? So this is sort of how it started. It was sort of our coping mechanism. You know, whenever we lost Lola, you know, we would just make up stories.
And now the story is in print. Now, you are a mum of three. How did you find time to write this?
I made time. I think you probably know as well, you're busy. You know, you just have to organize yourself. You have to say, you know what, I'll make time for it no matter what it takes. And actually, it took a couple of times before I actually really managed to go and write it, because I started about 5 years ago, sat down, wrote a little bit, and then something happened. Another baby happened, another move happened, COVID kicked in, and then actually at the worst time possible, which was when we moved from Europe back to Dubai, during COVID, I was like, no, I'm going to write it now, whatever it takes. And what I did, I just made time every, you know, for about 2 hours every morning, where I just sit down, like lock myself in and wrote. Well, I didn't really lock myself in because, you know, you have kids then
you
coming
can't.
In. You can't, you know, but, you know, I think it's about being determined, wanting to do it, set yourself a goal and then just go with it. Go for it.
I need to ask you about the illustrations because I completely fell in love with them. And for me, that's what children fall in love with, too. How did you find an illustrator that could really bring this story to life, and what was working with them like?
Yeah, that was the main, as you say, that's the main thing for a book. I mean, you know, for an author, it's about the words you want to write. But the kids, I mean, really what the story like really makes it exciting for them are the pictures. So I was very determined to find someone that I like, that, you know, whose pictures I would like to look at. So I did a lot of research. You know, I met with some local people here. I've met loads of people. And some of them gave me drawings, but I was like, no, not quite right. And I found it through an online marketplace for freelancers called Readsy. And you have some that I think they're going through a vetting process. And so she was one of them. And I've asked her if she could maybe do a character drawing. I gave her a brief of what I sort of had in mind. I think the main thing for her was between for us to click, she really liked the story. Mm-hmm. She really, really liked it. And she said, like, she kept checking every single day to see whether there was a response from me in the mailbox. And I mean, it's love at first sight. When I saw the pictures, it was literally butterflies in my tummy. It was like, this is it. No matter what it takes, like, we are going to work together. And which is quite a challenge because, yes, we had COVID, but she also doesn't live here in the UAE. She lives actually in Chile.
Okay, so time differences as well.
Yes, there was a bit of time difference as well. And so I think the majority of our work collaboration was done online. Yeah, we met a couple of times, you know, via Google Meet, but most of the time it was in writing, you know, so I would share a lot of my thoughts. It was a lot of writing. Usually what happened, you know, she would usually send the illustrations or the drawing in like at around midnight my time. And then when I would wake up in the morning, I would look at them and be like, oh, this is really great.
This is going to be a good
day. Or, oh my gosh, we have to work a little bit more on that. But I really like that, like really getting involved, not just submitting the manuscript to a publisher, but to actually working on the book and really making this your baby. I
it's
mean,
your
that
fourth
was
baby.
The most amazing experience. And I'm really glad I didn't miss that.
We are on Facebook Live. So let's have a look at the book.
Yes.
It is called, as I said, Hop Lola Hop. Tell us a little bit about the story and the central characters.
So the story is about Lola and her best friend Ella. Is that the right one? her best friend Ella. So they're great friends. They're having lots of adventures. Anything you remember, really, which is, you know, they're doing a lot of imaginative play. And it's something I actually used to do. I would actually watch my children, what they like doing. Like, you know, we had these Kipson's cardboard boxes and they'd do anything with it. They turn it into a boat, they would turn it into a bus, into a post office, whatever. And I thought, you know what, this is brilliant. Like, this is the stuff they like to play. You know, we don't always need like really big fancy playgrounds. This is the stuff they really like, which to me is like the core definition of being a child.
It is.
So this is what happened. And so Siski, actually, that was one of the first images she sent to me, which is why I fell in love. So she made this beautiful little paper boat. Which is exactly that, what, you know, reflects to me, because as a kid, you don't even need like a fancy cardboard box with like all the right colors, you know, like, and your imagination does the rest for it. And so this is really like, I think for me is the essence of the book as well. Mm-hmm. So yes, so what happens, we do a lot of this, and then Ella and Lola go on their normal, regular day-to-day walk. There's a bit of a hiccup because Ella hurts herself. She hurts herself, gets upset, and what happens? They need a plaster. I mean, plasters do a lot for kids, right?
Oh my
right?
goodness, plasters are high-value currency in our household.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have boxes of them in all shapes and colours and sizes because for special injuries, they're special plasters. Right?
And I'm there, I've got my glasses on going, I think I can see the injury you're talking about.
Yes.
We'll put a plaster on
there's
just
blood,
to be
there's
case.
There's blood, there's blood. So there's a lot of that. And that sort of sets it off because Lola does not really like the stroller. She thinks it's really dull and boring to sit in the stroller. She wants to do other things.
So Lola goes AWOL.
She goes AWOL, exactly that. And that's what happens. And then what I've done in the story is we obviously see Ella being really upset. You know, she's looking for her bunny everywhere. But at the same time, we're also following the bunny to see what she's actually up to. And she's actually having an amazing adventure.
Learns to swim.
I don't want to tell more, though.
Okay, but she does learn to swim. it is such a gorgeous book. It really, really is. And I have to say, it's interesting because here in Dubai, we've got this little kind of publishing scene as such. And I kind of think, you know, how would that compare to books in the wider world? And with your book, and I'm honestly not just saying this because you're in front of me, it is absolutely world-class writing, gorgeous illustrations, it's stunning. So if you've got three children, are you going to write three books?
Hopefully, yes. I think, you know what, we didn't lose her once. We lost her many, many times, I like to say. So I think there's a lot of, you know, I've got a lot of in the back of my mind of what I could do. And I would love to continue this. It's the most amazing job and very rewarding, I have to say.
So more adventures for you and for Lola. I want to ask you just briefly, it's a self-published book.
Yes.
Any advice to anyone out there who's thinking about going down a similar route?
Yes, I mean, I think what is really nice, it's the good news is it's a very diversified market these days. You don't have to go through a traditional publisher, but you might have to wait years to find something. You can do it yourself. You have, you know, things like print on demand to do it. I think the main thing is, you know, you have to be passionate about the project. You have to be aware that it's not just about you writing in your little cabin. It's a whole lot more, you know. Mm-hmm. If you want to do it yourself, it's you are the CEO of this writing journey. You know, you're writing, you're doing the art direction, you're finding the designers, you're doing the logistics, the warehousing, the selling, absolutely everything. So I have to say, I thought, you know, this is this romantic notion that you have of, you know, writing this beautiful picture book. And I mean, the creative process, amazing. Now it comes to all the other things, you know, and you have to speak to other, you know.
You're like me, a words girl, not an Excel spreadsheet person. Yeah. And I'm like, why am I dealing now with logistics?
Anyone with, you know, with good ideas how to actually get this Excel spreadsheet going, I'd be really grateful to hear about that.
When is the book going to be available and where from?
It's already on pre-order. So you can go onto Amazon here in the UAE, also to Kinokuniya. It will also be available in the bookstores here as well in Dubai from next month.
It is a thing of beauty. And if you do want a little sneak peek, you can have a look. Kathy Urban-Oberg is the author of Hop Lola Hop. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing a little insight into this world. I think it's one that a lot of kids are going to enjoy exploring. And looking forward to seeing what Lola gets up to in the future. We love talking books. We love meeting authors. If you've got any recommendations, get in touch. 4001 is the SMS. You can use your ARN Play app as ever.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking families, children's mental health, specifically teens on the show today, because teens of today live in a totally different world to the one that their parents grew up in. Not only do young people have access to technologies that previous generations barely dreamed of, but they're constantly bombarded with information from news and media. So today's youth are living through the end of a pandemic. And living through that pandemic has inevitably created an extra layer of difficulty that's already a very challenging age, and it has taken its toll on their mental health. A crisis, in fact. According to Mental Health America, nearly 14% of youths aged 12 to 17 experienced a major depressive episode in the last year. In 2020, September survey of high schoolers by Active Mind says 75% of respondents reported an increase in stress, anxiety, sadness and isolation during the first 6 months of the pandemic. So we're bringing in the experts, and today joining us on the phone is Dr. Chasti O'Connell, Clinical Director at Thrive Wellbeing Centre. Dr. Chasti, thank you for being with us. The stats, and we often struggle to get data from this part of the world, but the data out of the US and the UK is beyond alarming. And I wondered if you're seeing a reflection of that in the number of teen patients coming into Thrive, and indeed what issues or concerns are they coming to talk to you about?
They are coming in with challenges related to anxiety, depression, and a lot of that sort of the aftermath or residue of the pandemic.
When a teen is sitting down, you know, in the chair and, you know, you ask that simple question, you know, what's brought you here today? What are some of the most common answers?
It's such painful, deep topics. Like, I feel this deep sense of loneliness or defectiveness or brokenness. So really, when they're describing these experiences, it's just sort of this consuming struggle around how do I make it through the day, really, for a number of teens, and feeling the pressure from certainly academics, sort of strained relationships between parents and teens, but also what it means to function and be a teen in today's world, which is navigating, you know, in-person interactions in our schools, and as well as social media and the just enormous impact that has on how teens see themselves, how they interact, where they get ideas, where they experiment with identity. And so, you know, but going back to the point that the question that you raised, it really is down to, you know, this sense of alienation, not knowing who they are, and they're not supposed to developmentally. That's mm-hmm. what they're working through. But that sense of brokenness, that there's something wrong with me, what's wrong with me, I can't do this.
I would imagine, and this is again me completely jumping to conclusions and perhaps, I don't know, you'll tell me, but you know, do you feel like there is an inclination for over-labeling or in people seeking a bit of a badge of honour with a diagnosis? They're finding their tribe and saying, you know, I have anxiety, I have depression, and this might excuse certain behaviours or create something of an identity.
So what we want to do therapeutically is really help introduce the process of what it means to be a teenager going through this period of adolescence. It is natural to question. It is natural to not know. It's natural to not foreclose on an idea and, you know, be wedded to it at this point in your life. So a lot of that work is kind of opening up and allowing them to explore themselves and different aspects of themselves, and kind of helping them put the pause button on needing to self-identify, needing to have that diagnosis. And again, if they have a diagnosis, they meet criteria, then that's really important in terms of treatment. But from a deeper perspective on, you know, how you can help teens work through this, it really is the how to help them tolerate the distress, not knowing, and of being, and what I mean by not knowing, the not knowing as being part of the process of being a teen,
yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, because things are messy. Things aren't going to get tied up with it with a neat little bow.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking teen mental health on the show this afternoon. Delighted to be joined by Clinical Director at Thrive Wellbeing Centre. It's Dr. Chastity O'Connell. And we've seen huge, unfortunate rises in the reporting of teen mental health issues over the last 5 years. The pandemic, well, they existed before the pandemic, but it seems the pandemic seems to have certainly, you know, exacerbated or compounded some of these issues. The result, more teens in therapy than ever before, talk of self-harm and worse. So Dr. Chastity, can we talk about how parents can really broach some of these topics if there is a concern?
One of the most important things to introduce for parents is that the conversation around a teen's mental health is going to be one of a million conversations. So it's a process. And I think sometimes parents go in and they're really worried, they're alarmed. And so their sort of stress and, you know, agitation around what's going on, you know, inadvertently gets put onto the teen to come up with answers, to be disclosing, to tell the parent what's going on. And if there isn't kind of, you know, established connection in the relationship, that can be really hard. And oftentimes teens will just shut down because, you know, there's this sort of pressure or expectation in the relationship. So the first thing is, parents, this is one of many conversations that you're going to have with your teen. And then the next is just being able to not say anything and allow them the opportunity to speak. So really honoring that they may not say anything to you in that first conversation. And that first conversation might be a minute long where parent says, hey, I'm really worried about you. What can I do to support you? Do you want to talk to someone? And most of the time the teen will be like, I'm fine. And then they storm off to their room for the next 3 days. And so then it's just gently revisiting that, and rather than escalating it and trying to demand answers, just gently revisiting it from time to time. And through that process, the parent is communicating, hey, I'm here when you're ready. And then when teens start disclosing, the listening skills and the holding skills of parents can be critically important. And oftentimes parents are so well-intentioned, they're stressed themselves, they've also gone through a pandemic, and they want to make everything better. And so the teen might say, well, you know, my best friend isn't speaking to me. And the parent, well-intentioned, might say something like, oh, well, you know what, they weren't very nice to you anyway. So this is, you know, you can go find a new friend. You're such a lovely person. Mm-hmm. And again, that's really not attuning to what the teen is needing in that moment. So when in doubt, nod and say, exactly what you just did. And if you're feeling more savvy as a parent, then you might repeat back what the person said. You know, I hear you saying that you're really upset about this situation. And just that very subtle, you know, communication lets the team know that you're receptive, that you're listening, that you've paused whatever agenda you might have, because as parents, we want to, we worry about our kids. Everything can be a teachable moment.
It can be, but we want to fix everything, you know, whether that is on a practical basis or an emotional basis. And you know, as you say, that kind of well-intentioned soothing, I guess, it might not be that helpful. So I guess my question is, when do you go to a professional?
Whenever you see signs of any kind of suicidality or self-harm, those are some major red flags there. So for more subtle red flags are whenever you see dips in their academic performance, and this isn't about the performance itself, it's about that performance being an indicator that something might not be going on. When you see your teen not engaging in the social activities that they previously were. So this is where we're talking about the impairments or the impact in their functioning. You're seeing them change. They're spending more time in their room. They're not going to sports practice. They're not interested in music, and they've loved music. So whenever you start seeing some kind of major changes, those are the times to start having that conversation. But when it comes to suicidality or self-harm or drastic changes in behavior, that's when it's really important to try and reach out to a professional as soon as possible.
Chastity, can I ask you lastly about the reluctance that we might have from parents to get the mental help that their teens might need? And that might be through stigma, you know, fear of labeling, worry about being a quote-unquote bad parent. Is this something that you've seen in the past?
If you had asked me pre-pandemic, I would say that it was more noticeable. But I think because there are so many teens in crises, and that parents are connected in some ways through their own communities, social media, WhatsApp groups, that there's sort of almost like a sense of, okay, we need to do something about it, almost like a permission around getting help a little bit. There's still stigma. There's always going to be stigma. But I think in terms of what I'm experiencing, and again, anecdotally with other clinicians, there is a sense of parents coming in, I'm really worried. We still have a long way to go with regard to stigma, but I do think that because there is so much information around teens struggling, and you hear about it in certainly schools and so forth, there's, I think, a bit more openness for parents to reach out.
Chastity, can I ask you to put your kind of mum hat on as well? And
sure.
What are some of the things that you're planning to do when your kids get to that teenage age in order to bolster their mental health, you know, mental wellness, I suppose?
Yeah, it's such a tender question, you know, and as a mom, it really is about keeping that line of communication open. That's my primary focus. And so right now it's just practicing my listening skills, practicing being able to receive what they say and not tell them, well, that's wrong, you should think that way, and just letting them know that no matter what, I am a safe space. You can come to me. And even if it's something you've done wrong, you've, you know, done something that you're ashamed of, I'm not going to rub your nose in it. I'm not going to throw it up in your face. You know, there are things that are just off limits when it comes to, you know, shaming our children. And so that's the most important thing I want my kids to know, is that when it comes down to it, if you're struggling, I want to be the first person that you call.
And lastly, what do you think needs to change on a societal level in order to better protect our teens?
A societal perspective, I think it's just much more mental health parity with medical conditions. So making sure that insurance covers mental health services, also preventative services, curriculum in schools. So the best treatment for mental health problems is prevention. And so the extent to which We have sort of psychological well-being classes in school, or what it means to have a healthy relationship, or how to consume social media and not in a sort of the way that grown-ups might do it, but in a way that's crafted by teens, but approved by mental health professionals. Mm-hmm. But again, really emphasizing our prevention programs, opportunities for prevention and education, and again, having teens come in before it's crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. When it comes to availability at the clinic, I know you're all very busy, but you know, what are some of the services that are on offer there if people are listening today and thinking, actually, this is really, you know, giving us food for thought?
You call up, you will, at many of the clinics, you'll receive a really lovely receptionist who will ask you about some of the challenges you're facing. I think parents are sometimes hesitant to share. And so in that, you know, you can just say, I'm worried that my child is struggling. And from there, you'll meet with a clinician that'll, you know, certainly get a background history on, you know, what they're facing. They'll meet with the team and certainly get their perspective on it, and then come up with a really individualized plan to help them work through whatever challenge they are experiencing.
Do you think conversations such as this do make us all realize that, you know, a lot of kids sadly are struggling, but that means on the plus side that if you're worried about your own child, they're certainly not alone in that, and there is certainly the experts in place to help out when needed. So thank you for your time, Dr. Shasti O'Connell, speaking to us from Thrive Wellbeing Centre. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.